History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are untold stories there that need to be told and that definitely need to be heard. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today we get to meet 95-year-old Joe Reyes of Fresno, California, who served with the 473rd Anti-Aircraft Artillery in Europe during World War II. But why don't we start out with your childhood, Joe?
Well, I grew up in Monterey Seaside. I remember my dad and I used to go out clam hunting when the tide was out. Then on one day, he decided to go to Mexico. He made the truck like a covered wagon. He said, "We're going to Mexico." Well, it's no big deal to me. I was a young boy. He got the truck loaded with the supplies that we're going to need. We went to Mexico. Our aim was to get to Sonora. We faced rain, wind, and then one time we faced Apaches. They go out in front of the truck over there, and Dad didn't take out the Winchester he had in the truck. He was wise. So he got out and he talked to them. You can see the big feathers on them, you know. And I looked at him. To me, that was wonderful to see Indians like that. But to him, they knew what he had to do. So he went back to the truck and he got a sack full of corn, brought it out, gave it to the Indians. They were satisfied. They took off. Well, after that, we faced thunder and rain, lightning. We got to a doggone bridge that was swaying from the torrent of the river, you know. In those days, they didn't make bridges like they do today, you know. You could see the bridge moving a little bit. He says, "We gotta go across now, or if we wait, this lava will wash the bridge out." As we went on, you could see the truck swaying from one side to the other a little bit. I was scared. He didn't show no fear. Well, we made it across. As soon as we got to Sonora, we headed to a town named Ciudad Obregón. And that's where we began our stay in Sonora for 5 years. I attended school, and I learned Spanish real good. The only time we spoke English was at home. My mother and father did not allow us to speak English out in the crowd or anything. We were afraid they might think that we're talking about them. And some of those people despised that. We went to school. We stayed there for about 5 years before we lose our citizenship. My father and my mother had a disagreement one day, so she decided to leave him and come back. He brought us back on the truck, clear to a place that my Aunt Marion had acquired for us to stay. He unloaded the truck for whatever things we had very little, and he went back. From there, we just stayed with my aunt. Pretty soon my mother got a job, and we moved to Sunset Bunker Hill, about 2 miles from Hollywood. And there I acquired a dishwashing job there. Attended school, which I was enrolled in the fifth grade.
So you're born in America. English is your first language. You go into Mexico, and your parents say, "Don't speak any English. They're going to discriminate against you for speaking English," right?
That's right, yes. And if we went to a restaurant, we didn't speak no English because for the same reason. Some people are, you know, they just don't like, they call us repatriados. You know what that means? We're deported. That's what they thought we were because they could tell that we were not original Mexicans.
Well, it just hit me that here you're in Mexico and you have to be concerned about being discriminated against because you're American, but then also here in America, you face discrimination for being Mexican-American.
I did that while I was in the service, when I had different jobs. The only place I didn't receive discrimination was when this World War II veteran hired me to do welding jobs in his shop. It was over there in Frisco. And then another time that I never faced discrimination was when I was a heavy-duty mechanic. From there on, no one discriminated. We're all in the same boat. We're heavy-duty mechanics. I finally retired from there. By that time, the wife was always saving the nickels and dimes, you know. And we decided to travel, see America. I wanted to see America because I fought for my country. And I almost died several times. Came close to dying twice, three times. But man, it was close enough to turn you white. All of us in the center half track. One of them boys, one time, he says, "Joe, you look better brown than white." That was Andrew J. Scopetti. I'll never forget his name because we were real close. Uh-huh. He was Italian from Brooklyn, and we became best friends.
And long before that, you had to learn hard work. When you were 15, you went to the Civilian Conservation Corps?
It was advertised in the paper that if you wanted to learn about trees, you know, different kinds of trees, trails, streams, how to make cattle guards, how to fight fires, which we did fight fires, and we came pretty close to be trapped in a pocket of fire. The foreman knew what was coming, and he says, "Let's get out of here right now." You know, and then we hightail it, and you can see the fire coming over the top of the trees. You won't believe this. We were running, and it was a canal. We were running over the bridge. You look to the right like that. There was all kinds of animals and the doggone water rushing, getting away from the fire. Nobody was fighting nobody. Everybody, all the animals were in the same boat. They were running from the fire. You'll never forget that sight.
You mean like bears and deer and raccoons and anything that lives in the forest is all running the same way?
All of them were in the same canal. And you could tell they were all scared because of the fire. So we escaped that and they sent it some other direction to fight, make fire trails, you know, and all that stuff. And there was about 15 to 20 of us. I'd say about 20. And we make fire trails all day long. We get in about 11 o'clock at night. 5 o'clock, we had to get up and take off again until the fire was controlled by the fire department. Not many acres burned then. They really got the fires under control fast. So we were glad that it was over with because there was hard work all day long, you know, out there. We make fire trails. We had a mop-up. You know what a mop-up is? You get a strap of a 10-gallon can on your back with a syringe. Well, we're all lined up, and you walk, and you see it smothering, and you get the syringe to put it out. All day long, you go with that syringe. You gotta go into a stream and you fill up again. Not only me, and be about 20 of them sprung out. The foreman knew what he was doing. There, after everything in the fire was over and everything was under control, we had just go back to camp and go to our duties of maybe knocking down dead trees, planting new trees after a fire. We would plant trees all day long. We had like a sack. And you knew how to pull out each little tree. And you hit the ground with a mattock, pull back, drop the tree, let the soil go back to cover the tree. That was all day long. You're through with one sack full, you got another one. And we were strung out. Anyone that travels above Norfolk can see the trees lying. Because those are the trees we planted.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. So you planted these almost 80 years ago. And so those trees have grown a little bit. How many times have you gone back up there to see the trees you planted?
I never did go back over there. You know, once I got so busy with my life, you know, working, and so I never went back up there. I should have really to see our work. But a beautiful trees by now.
So teenagers today, they have a hard time understanding what this was. Well, here you're 15 years old, and you're going, and you're working hard. It's almost like being in the military, but then the money that you were earning would go back to your family?
Because we had everything there. Laundry, food, quarters, barracks to sleep in. So that Camp Tuolumne, they called it, up North Fork. There was very little money then, but I learned a lot. I learned about trees. I learned about, animals, from rattlesnakes on up. It was really gratifying. To me, it was very good experience that I had.
You would get to keep $5, and then 25 went to your family back home?
Yes, at that time, yes, yeah. To help Mom. Yeah. That was a lot of money in those days, $25.
It kind of sounds like that made you grow up a little bit.
My experience made me sometimes a little more hardened. When I clenched my fists and I wanted to whack somebody that made a remark about my race, But I said, and I got nothing to gain. He's not hurting me anyhow. So I let that go. But I already had the experience of welding under my belt because I get out of school and go to a welding class. And I became a certified welder, a mechanical welder. And I used that because every shop I went to, welding was required. I came right out of high school, and no time at all, I got a job in a defense plant as a welder. $1.10 an hour, top wages. Not a money in those days, a dollar. It's equivalent to 30 now. My mom had that nursery across the tracks. It was Glendale. One day I come home, and she said, look, son. She brought out the papers, a big write-up, about the Army and all the privileges. If you enlist, son, he says, it'd be better if you enlist because they are offering him whatever you want in the Army. That's what you'll have. You got your choice. If you are drafted, you have no choice. They put you where they want. So I was kind of skeptical about that, So I finally said, okay, I'll enlist. They're going to draft me anyhow.
Well, would you have had a deferment because of your defense plant job?
No, I didn't think about a deferment at all. But to my experience, here's what happens. I was going up on the beach in Omaha with the half tracks. The infantry was right there coming off the landing barges. And there was this fellow walking along in the infantry beside my half track. He looks up at me, hey, Joe, what are you doing up there? He said, what do you think, man? I enlisted, you got drafted in your own foot. Yeah, I said, man, I should have listened to you. That's what he said. Well, I didn't think about a deferment at all. To my knowledge, he told me the plant closed up after 3 months because they had the supply of those square tanks that we used to weld. I'm getting ahead of myself. We come off the landing barges, and I look down as the half track moved in a little bit this way, and I look down. Those big tanks that we made were full of air, and they supported our half tracks, tanks, and infantry, That's what they would use them for, floating pontoons.
So what you were welding were big tanks that they would fill with air so they could have pontoon barges?
They were on the water, full of air. They supported. It's the only thing I think of because otherwise, why would they have them down there? And they moved a little. It's a heavy. Tanks went over them, They even move a light half tracks. And you think you're going to flip over. But they supported our troops, tanks and all.
So it's possible that your half track drove ashore over those pontoons that you had actually welded.
Yes, because they had to use the pontoons because the barges were heavy with equipment and they can only go so far. They're way down on the water and before they hit the beach. So they had to have pontoons to float so that the barges that were carrying the equipment, trucks and everything, were able to get off. That's what they were for.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we'll hear some of what Joe Reyes experienced over the year that followed, including some of his closest calls in Europe. Find photos and video of Joe at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.